This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for being with us today. More than 40 years after the civil rights movement, Milwaukee remains one of the most segregated cities in America. How many times have you heard some variation of that phrase? Probably a lot.
I have heard that we are the second most segregated city behind Boston. I don't know if that's true or not, but as a bicycle messenger, I do understand that there are some sections of the city where there are no black people, and there are other sections of the city where there are no white people. So that would be segregation to me, and I think it's a bad thing. We should integrate a little bit more.
I think it's a big problem in Milwaukee. I actually heard that Milwaukee is like the second most segregated city in the United States or something like that. So, yeah, I definitely think it's a problem.
We recorded those two comments on Wisconsin Avenue on Tuesday. Years ago, there were various rules on the books that effectively kept whites in some communities and African Americans in others, but today the factors that caused the separation are more subtle and complex. Many people talked about the election of President Barack Obama last year as a sign that we are moving towards becoming a post-racial society, that we're approaching the day when we no longer even think about racial distinctions. But we don't have a colorblind city, at least not yet. For our Project Milwaukee Black and White series, we wanted to get past the anecdotes and find out why Milwaukee's racial dynamic is the way it is. Over the next week and a half, we'll get some firsthand historical perspective, and we'll spotlight some parts of the current situation that may just surprise you. We'll also broadcast the Project Milwaukee Forum on Race Relations that takes place next week. To understand race relations in Milwaukee and across Wisconsin, it's important to get a historical perspective. The history of race relations here is often contradictory, with some shining moments from a national perspective to some much darker, some would say shameful periods in Milwaukee history. Later in the Project Milwaukee series, we'll hear some firsthand historical accounts. But first, John Goethe is our regular history contributor on Lake Effect. He's been studying the history of Milwaukee since 1972 and has authored 18 books, including The Making of Milwaukee. Goethe starts at the beginning for Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke.
The first black in Milwaukee was a man named Joe Oliver, who arrived back in 1835. So when you look at it, there have been African Americans in Milwaukee as long as there has been a Milwaukee. This was the year of the first public land sale back in 1835. And Joe Oliver had worked as a cook on the Great Lakes and came off the lakes to work for Solomon Juneau, who was the most important fur trader here in Milwaukee, arriving back in 1818. So he was here on the ground very early. He voted in Milwaukee's first election back in 1835. So this was a very early blow for suffrage. And he came here as all of the whites, virtually all the whites, and you know, the African-Americans as well, came for opportunity. And for an African-American, the horrendous circumstance that much of the country was slave territory, and Wisconsin, of course, was free. And 1865, a man named Ezekiel Gillespie, who was a pillar of Milwaukee's black community, a railway porter by trade, filed suit with the state Supreme Court to win back the right to vote, which had been denied after Joe Oliver voted, and the state Supreme Court upheld his suit. So we were early on a hotbed of both abolitionist sentiment and suffrage.
Although, if I understand correctly, despite the fact that an initial referendum allowed blacks the right to vote, it was subsequently struck down by a court ruling and then a couple of subsequent referendums before it was returned.
The question is what constituted a majority, and it was majority of the residents or a majority of those who voted, and it was determined finally by the state Supreme Court that a majority of those who voted, you know, were the ones who made the decision, and that was the referendum that ended up being the case that settled, you know, the right for African Americans to vote in Wisconsin. But yes, you're right, there was legal shifting for a number of years before that was finally awarded.
Well, as you say, Wisconsin was admitted to the Union as a so-called free state. Aside from the fact that slavery wasn't legal here, did blacks have other significant rights that they did not have in other parts of the country?
I think the pattern in Milwaukee, certainly by 1850, there were roughly 100 African Americans in Milwaukee, and they owned property, they were in the professions, they lived in all sections of town. It was not until the later 1800s that you had more residential clustering in the area on the west side, just north of Milwaukee's downtown. And that census of 1850 included a number of cooks, a number of barbers, and one lone farmer, one African-American farmer. And it's not known, you know, where he had his holdings. So, yes, they did have the same rights and took advantage of them in the same way as white Americans. That does not mean this was a colorblind society. The U.S. has not been and is not now a colorblind society. And there were incidents of violence. The most serious in 1861 ended in the lynching of an African-American who was involved in a fight with a couple of residents of the Irish Third Ward. And that was certainly a wake-up call to some folks. There was horror about violence in the streets. At the same time, there was ethnic violence going on between Irish and Germans, between some of the Germans and the Yankees over issues of prohibition. So it was not that we were the Wild West, but there was a rather lower level of public order here than we've come to take for granted.
Well, and you mentioned the Irish, and Milwaukee is known for having its various settlements of various immigrant groups. Did blacks represent simply just one of a patchwork of immigrants, if you will, to this part of the state?
Yes, they did. There were very, very strongly drawn lines here that lasted longer than in most U.S. cities of who we constituted. And what that meant, among other things, was who them constituted. So you had the Irish Third Ward, you had the German North Side, you had the Yankee Hill on the east side. The South Side was polyglot, that was quite mixed. But yes, African Americans here were one group in a collection of very sharply defined cultures here.
And so relations between all immigrant groups, not just blacks and Irish, but Irish and Germans and Germans and blacks, and it was the same issues faced those relations across the board.
I'd say that's true. They would cooperate when it was convenient on issues of legislation. They would be in open conflict when they felt their own interests were being threatened by another group. There was always the special circumstance that people of color were singled out, and African Americans in particular, fighting the legacy of slavery that was still going on in the South. It was certainly not the same as an Irish or a German. The circumstance of color singled them out for treatment that was in many cases more severe.
In terms of the legacy of slavery, was Milwaukee a destination for either former slaves or escaped slaves?
The answer is yes. We were part of the Underground Railroad. There were places in the state, they're probably better known, Beloit, certainly a center of the Underground Railroad, a station on the Underground Railroad. But there was a famous incident here back in 1854 that would be the subject of an entire show, and that was the rescue of a fugitive slave named Joshua Glover. And there was a rally that was attended by an estimated 5,000 people. And this is when there weren't that many people in Milwaukee. At Courthouse Square, Glover was freed and spent the rest of his life in Canada, lived into his 80s. And it really established Wisconsin's credibility as a stronghold of abolitionism. A man named Governor Alexander Randall, who was Camp Randall Stadium in Madison, his name for, was what they called a fire-breathing abolitionist. And on his watch, Wisconsin declared the Federal Fugitive Slave Act unconstitutional. A state Supreme Court declared a federal law unconstitutional. No one in the Union did that. So at a time when the South was about to secede, Wisconsin was declaring its separatism for a different reason, in opposition to slavery. So that really, is kind of a high point in sort of the moral journey of this state.
So what happened after the Civil War?
There was a continued movement of freed women from the South. A man named Sully Watson was already here. He went back to the 1850s. And he was kind of the patriarch of Milwaukee's black community. And by 1869, there were enough blacks in Milwaukee to support a church. And if you ever travel downtown Milwaukee and go past the Hyatt Hotel on 4th and Kilbourne, there's a historical marker there that marks the site of St. Mark's African Methodist Church, which was founded back in 1869. And that became the focal point for African-American worship and socializing as well. And St. Mark is still thriving up on 16th and Atkinson. It is, by definition, the oldest of Milwaukee's African-American congregations and just a real pillar of that community. And when you think about it, 1869 is when St. Mark's is organized, and that's roughly 40 years, 50 years before the Italians and the Greeks get organized in Milwaukee. So a lot of us, you know, don't realize the depth of the roots of Milwaukee's African-American community. St. Mark is one good example. At the same time, this was a fairly small community relative to the city's population size. As late as 1910, there were about 1,000 people in Milwaukee of African descent.
John Goerda is Lake Effects History Contributor. We'll be back with the second half of his historical overview of race relations in Milwaukee after a short break. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. Welcome back to Lake Effect. Just before the break, historian John Goerda gave us a brief overview of race relations in Milwaukee during the 19th century. Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke wondered what the dynamic between the races was like as Milwaukee moved into the 20th century.
The turn of the 20th century was just a real kind of a woolly wild time in Milwaukee and America's history. You have just a tidal wave of immigration from Southern and Eastern Europe. And that created all kinds of dislocations among both the earlier Yankees as well as the northern Western Europeans. The word that may have been used was chaos. It was a rather chaotic time in urban America. And African Americans were very much a part of that mix. And by that time, you know, the Civil War had become pretty much a fading memory. And we were beginning to kind of enter the more modern period of race relations and race conflict and racism. You know, that certainly is part of American society and was certainly in the early 1900s. But there was the movement from the South that began around those years, early 1900s. In this region, most of that went to Chicago. And the fact that we were kind of in Chicago's shadow from that movement from the South really had kind of a formative impact on Milwaukee's African-American community. There were, by 1930 or so, I think about 1.3% of Milwaukee's population was African-American. In Chicago, by contrast, it was 7%, so five times the proportion of the population. And they were coming for the same reasons. There were jobs here in the urban industrial north, in both service occupations and in blue-collar work. You know, Milwaukee was obviously a very important center of manufacturing. And African Americans before World War I were working in the Milwaukee area foundries, factories, tanneries, packing plants. So they came in search of jobs.
How integrated a community was Milwaukee, at least early on?
Early on, African Americans lived everywhere. You know, north side, south side, east side, west side. My dad was raised in the South Side on 32nd and Lincoln and recalls black families in that neighborhood back in the teens and 20s. But around that time and even earlier, there were clear signs of segregation going on in Milwaukee. As long as there was a relatively small population, it was scattered, as there was both the native tendency to cluster, which is part of every group's instinct. At the same time, the special circumstance of racism saying you're not welcome here, and so people began to settle more dominantly in the area just north of downtown on the west side. And that core area, the area between roughly the Schlitz Brewery and what's now the Pabst Brewery, you know, around the Hillside Housing Project, they called it the Haymarket neighborhood. That had been German, it became Eastern European Jewish, and that was becoming, by the early 1900s, African-American as well. And they became the dominant group in that neighborhood, and just as the Germans used that neighborhood as kind of their niche, their foothold, and moved out to the north and west, blacks did the same thing, you know, from the near north side, moved out to the north and west, and continues today, you know, all the way out to the northwestern county line, you know, here in Milwaukee.
The area you were describing before was what came to be known as Bronzeville, is that right?
Bronzeville is a little bit farther north. It's okay. Around Walnut. And the area that is currently the focus of restoration, preservation, redevelopment efforts is between 3rd and 7th, roughly, and north of North Avenue, and a little bit south as well, the Halyard Park area. So that was the black communities downtown, as well as their Cedar Recreation Entertainment. And for whites as well, coming to hear good music. You know, Walnut Street was a real venue, real popular place to visit. The term used is the Great Migration, and that was 1910 to 1930 in its first incarnation. Around that time, you have the population in Milwaukee growing from roughly 1,000 to 7,500 in just 20 years. That was a very formative period in Milwaukee's history. And although Chicago absorbed more, there was a critical mass of African Americans here in the 1920s. And some institutions that date from that period, that is when the NAACP is founded here in Milwaukee. It's when the Urban League, Milwaukee Urban League, is established here. There was a newspaper called the Milwaukee Enterprise, dating from the teens and 20s, and a savings and loan called Columbia that was founded by a couple moved here from Beloit named Wilbur and Artie Halyard, who were hero and heroine in Milwaukee's black community, founded Columbia as the first black-owned financial institution in Wisconsin, and it's still there up on Fond du Lac, just south of North Avenue. So that was really in terms of both the establishment of churches, institutions, and kind of a sense of a critical mass of neighbors. So that was a very formative period for Milwaukee's African Americans.
When did Milwaukee start to see either unofficial or official regulations, laws, whatever, that more firmly drew lines between communities?
I think the pattern was not so much laws passed by the county board or common council. There were restrictive covenants and subdivisions that forbade the sale of lots to, in some cases, African Americans and other cases, Jews. No, these were covenants that were not always enforced, but they were on the books and sort of were the embodiments of, you know, the American pattern, not just the Milwaukee pattern by any means, but the American pattern of drawing lines. You know, you're out, we're in, us and them, you know, kind of dynamic. And that certainly began, or that certainly was established by the early 1900s. In terms of the real kind of the presence of racism here, the overt presence of racism here, early on, of course, the lynching back in 1861, there was a rather active group of Ku Klux Klan members back here in the 1920s. But that was the center, their power base was Indiana. So it was the North, you know, where the KKK really was resurgent back in the 1920s. And Milwaukee had its own clavern, was based in a mansion over on Kilbourne, about 24th Street. And that was Dan Hoan, you know, who was a socialist who governed Milwaukee, was the mayor from 1916 to 1940. He lampooned them as the Hoods and Nighties set, and said if they laid a hand on any Milwaukeean of any color, this would be the hottest place the side of hell, you know, for them. So there was in his case, the socialist case in general, an openness, a commitment to freedom, a commitment to equality. No, so that was part of the pattern as well. No, you have, it's always yin yang. You know, it's always a mixture of darkness and light. But there were high points as well. In the 1950s is when you have the second great migration. You know, that movement from the rural South to the urban North. And in Milwaukee's case, you have full employment for all ethnic groups during World War II. No, this was a real stronghold of industry, and we were a hugely important part of the arsenal of democracy that helped to win the war. And after the war, you have these jobs continuing after some dislocation, so there was a real attraction for both, not Europeans so much by then, but Latinos and African Americans as well, coming here in large numbers. And in Milwaukee's case, the black population swelled from roughly 3% of the city's population to 15% between 1950 and 1970. So that was a real, no, that's the beginning. That is the modern community being formed. And there was, in some cases, panic residentially in the white neighborhoods. There was blockbusting going on, rather unscrupulous real estate agents, you know, sort of fomenting fear and driving people out. And you have Frank Zeidler, who was mayor from 1948 to 1960. In both his 52 and 56 campaigns, there were charges that he was putting billboards up in the South urging blacks to come to Milwaukee. You know, just frankly racist charges, completely fabricated, completely false. But it does give you some idea of the tensions of the time in the 1950s.
Well, and that's where our story leaves off. Well, John Goethe, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you, Mitch.
Milwaukee-born writer and historian John Goethe is a Lake Effect contributor. He's been studying the history of Milwaukee since 1972 and has authored 18 books, including The Making of Milwaukee. John mentioned the Joshua Glover story as one of the bright spots in Wisconsin's racial history. Amateur historian George Gonis explains why knowing Joshua Glover's story is important for all of us next. We'll be back with that right after this short break. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio.